The first guy coming out of the box, Dr. Harvey Schiller. We've been looking at this one for a little while, and he's really done an awful lot of different things, really accomplished an awful lot. He's moved on, and he's now a corporate director in the non a corporate leader in the non sports realm at this point of his career, and that kind of sets it apart from what he's done previously. And as I say, all of this I take it was more or less a second career after being a brigadier general in the Air Force, because I got to believe that's a full time gig in and of itself. But everything that he has done subsequently, being at leading Turner Sports, the Southeastern Conference, the U.S. Olympic Committee, Yankees Nets, the International Baseball Federation, so many different things there that he has done. And presently, and this is going to be really interesting to find out about as well, this seems like a very cutting-edge type of path that he's on right now. Chairman of the Board and CEO of Global Options, Global Options Group. I wasn't sure I got the name right there, but yeah, Global Options Group. It's a company that battles fraud in the business sector. And we are, of course, at the FDH Lounge, a show where nothing is off topic. We love to talk about many different types of things with people, really anything interesting that they can talk about here. And we love people who really embody that kind of variety through their own experiences and their own perspectives, everything that they've done. Next hour, I'm sure, is going to be no different, with Dominic Chianese, Uncle Junior from The Sopranos, with the other many things that he's done. And so, in a way, I think this is going to be very similar to that as well, because I'm sure Dr. Schiller has a lot of interesting stories, and look forward to getting him on now. It's our pleasure to welcome to the FDH Lounge Dr. Harvey Schiller. Dr. Schiller, welcome to the program, sir. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. First thing I'd like to ask you, borrowing from what's going on in the headlines right now, this wouldn't have been necessarily my first question a week or so ago, but based on your experience in the Air Force, the situation in Libya right now, is there anything you can shed any light on as far as we've seen in recent days on the news what constitutes the parameters of a no-fly zone? What are some of the logistics involved in setting anything like this up? Can you shed a little light that would be helpful to our viewers?
Well, I'm certainly not privy to the specific targets that are selected, but as you might expect, a no-fly zone means knocking out all the anti-aircraft, destroying airplanes on the ground, as well as probably pitting runways and so forth, and trying to eliminate any acquisition of airplanes that are in the area from what you and I would call the friendly forces. But one of the things that I think has happened in this particular time is that all of the bombing so far has been what you and I would call pinpoint. In other words, they know where the targets are. They're hitting them exactly. They're trying to minimize casualties, but they certainly can knock out anything that they want to at any given time.
That's very interesting, because I'm sure they sequentially are going through different stages here as different things are being accomplished with this. And your primary combat experience was in Vietnam, correct?
Vietnam, a very different environment compared to Afghanistan, Iraq, the Middle East. Targets were well hidden because of the jungle foliage and just the terrain of that part of Southeast Asia. But as you might expect in that war, as they're finding in Afghanistan, it's very difficult to determine who the enemy is and who the friendlies are.
Oh, sure. You know, and probably a lot of apples and oranges, too. As you say, things were kind of buried in Vietnam versus the wide-open North African plains. That's going to be something, hopefully, that they can get this under control very very shortly here. As far as your experience and as far as the progression of your career, I kind of postulated as I was setting up the introduction here tonight that I'm guessing that most of your corporate experience came as more or less a second career after the Air Force. I don't imagine you were able to do a whole lot on the side during the timeline that you were in the Air Force, correct?
Well, that's true. It was a full-time position throughout the years that I served, the 24 years that I served in the military. But as for anyone, there's time to volunteer and to do things. And when I was assigned to the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, at the same time, the U.S. Olympic Committee moved their headquarters from New York to Colorado Springs. And I would spend free time volunteering for different sports that were there. And at the academy, they hosted a number of events which I was able to take part of. At the same time, I was functioning within the academy's environment in the NCAA and the collegiate world within the conference and all the other things that we're doing. That was part of my job at the academy. But I think volunteerism is open to anyone, and obviously I took it on as a career following that.
That's very interesting. I hadn't put two and two together on the timeline, but yeah, with the USOC also being based out of the same area there as the Air Force, that must have been really a rewarding kind of a thing. And in the one sense, you're serving your country, and in the other sense, with what you're doing with the stuff on the side here, getting involved in helping your country to be very competitive on the international athletic stage. And I understand, I don't know where this was on the timeline necessarily, but I know that you were involved with efforts to bring the Olympics to Atlanta also.
Well, yeah. Well, while still at the academy, you might remember that the L.A. Games occurred in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given permission to spend a few weeks helping with the competition there. Once I became the director of the Olympic Committee in late 89, early 90, the effort was going forward to help to bring the Games to the United States again in 1996, which was the 100th anniversary of the Games. Actually, while I was commissioner of the Southeastern Conference, Billy Payne and his group came to see me some 4 or 5 years before they actually came to bid, based upon my volunteer experience, and we set up a relationship through that time, which continued during my full-time job.
Well, that's interesting, the way that these things overlap here. As far as your time with the Southeastern Conference, I wanted to get some thoughts from you on that as well. We see in recent days here, I am saddened as a Tennessee basketball fan to see Bruce Pearl passing from the scene down in Knoxville right now. But as I look at the job of an SEC commissioner, and obviously you have a number of administrative things that you have to coordinate, but as it relates to discipline, it's my sense and the sense of probably a lot of people just looking at the surface here that you have to more or less make sure that you're tough enough on the member schools in there and that you're policing things properly, but that you're not, and you have to satisfy the NCAA, of course, but not going overboard. You don't want to penalize your schools unnecessarily in the intersectional games that they may have. Is that what it more or less comes down to when you're faced with looking at disciplinary things here, knowing that the NCAA is going to be taking a look at it later on, that you have to take that kind of a balance?
Well, I think every commissioner is a little bit different, and every conference is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
When I became a commissioner, the focus of the presidents was to ensure that the programs were being done honestly and above board, and that was a commitment that obviously they identified someone from the military to take on that position. The first line should always be from the institution, but unfortunately, as the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell, and David Stern in the NBA, and Gary Bettman and so forth, they often have to take a step forward and do things that the teams themselves won't do or the institutions won't do. And I think that's unfortunate because I think it really should be at the level of the team and the level of the institution. At the same time, there is absolutely no obligation for the conference to take any action. But what the conference should do is ensure that there's fair play and fair recruiting. Obviously, you control all of the officials for the conference in both men's and women's sports. But aside from that, you know, you're trying to ensure that the players on either side of the line or on the court or in the swimming pool or playing volleyball, whatever they are, meet the requirements that you expect in terms of eligibility. So it's a complex situation, but I felt during my tenure that the important thing was to hold to the highest standards.
Oh, absolutely. That's how you have to do it. And as somebody who's additionally a fan of Ohio State sports right now, seeing everything that they're going through, I can certainly attest that those kind of standards are necessary. And in looking at your timeline as commissioner of the SEC through 1989, how involved was your office with the subsequent expansion of the next couple of years from there? Was the ball really starting to roll a little bit when you were the commissioner there? Did it progress beyond any exploratory conversations?
Well, it started in a variety of different ways. At the institutional level, institutions like Georgia had national rivalries with South Carolina. and the Alabama and Mississippi schools had natural rivalries with Texas schools. And as you might remember, institutions such as Tulane and Georgia Tech had been in the conference before. In the discussion with the presidents about how to balance the interest of all the schools, we did a study and identified everything from academic programs to research to commitment to both men's and women's sports. And we looked at every major institution from Miami north to Virginia and as far west as Texas. And in considering the ones that seemed to come forward were what was eventually added to the conference was Arkansas and South Carolina. But I give a lot of credit to, you mentioned that you're a fan of Tennessee, to Doug Dickey, who was the athletic director at Tennessee when I was the commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And Doug had a long-term relationship with Frank Broyles, who was the athletic director at Arkansas. And the three of us got together one day, and Frank indicated that it was a very, very difficult world for him to live in. He was Arkansas, but all the other members of the Southwest Conference, Texas A&M and so forth, were all Texas institutions. And he felt that it was time for him to move the institution. It was in the best interest of the SEC for a school like Arkansas because they were very committed to their basketball and football programs as well as women's sports. And the same thing was true of South Carolina. So we started that process. When I left to go to the Olympic Committee, Roy Kramer picked up from there. The one thing that we were able to do was we found a loophole in the NCAA rules, which said that if you have more than 10 institutions, you can create a championship in that sport. So we told the NCAA that when we added two schools, we were going to have a football championship. Walter Byers, who was the head of the executive director in the NCAA at the time, called me up and said, well, you can't do that. And I said, well, sure I can. And he said, that was meant for sports like rowing and fencing and others where they had, like the old ECAC, where they had dozens of schools. I said, well, it doesn't say that in the rule book. And he cursed a little, and that was really the beginning of the SEC football championship, which is followed now by a lot of institutions. There's more on the table about that, about which would make a good history of why certain institutions like Texas, which wanted to be in, were not able to come in. Well, we can talk about that at another time.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that's fascinating on a couple different levels. First of all, with Frank Broyles, how personal relationships a lot of times can impact history in a way like that. I guess that's not surprising if you think about it in the corridors of power and relationships.
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. The facts are that most football coaches at every level have worked at a number of different institutions. They start out as a graduate assistant, and they work their way up, positions coaches and so forth, defense, offense, head coaches and so forth, and there tends to be a lot of movement. Well, if you add all those up, it's 3, 4, 5 times the number of coaches at each school, even more than you have in basketball or you have in any of the other baseball or any of the other sports. So there's this fraternity of football coaches that have worked east, west, north, south. Some go pro and come back, but there's somewhat of a fraternity among football coaches, which is somewhat unique in all of intercollegiate sports.
It's interesting. It really seems to kind of humanize history there to help you understand how these things happen. I mean, Arkansas coming in and the SEC going to that, becoming the first, you know, so-called super conference, that's an amazing part of history right there. And to think of the role that personal relationships formed in that is just kind of fascinating. What ended up being the thing that led you from the Olympic Committee there, because being based still in the Southeast, I presume, there, because you were at the SEC, then you were with the USOC and working with the local Olympic Committee, to Turner Sports. What was the impetus to moving over there?
Well, there were a couple of things. One, I had a long-term relationship with Ted Turner because Turner Broadcasting was the early Saturday broadcaster of SEC football.
Mm-hmm.
Before ESPN or the major networks picked up the game. So they were our conference carrier. And that relationship kept building, and Ted kept calling me and saying, come work here, come work here, come work here. And, you know, he had a fascination with the Olympic Committee as well, with the Goodwill Games that he started, which he looked at as an alternate Olympic competition. And I felt at the time that Atlanta was picked as the games. I had done all I could in terms of the marketing, and we had raised the majority of the money. I felt that it was time to turn it over to someone else, and everything worked out. Unfortunately, the Olympic Committee went through a series of executive directors after I left, I guess almost six or seven in a 10 or 12-year period. And they finally picked someone, Scott Blackman, that's the CEO right now, that's doing a terrific job.
You know, it with some of the names that you mentioned, not least of which Ted Turner, it does raise the question, Dr. Schiller, for somebody like you who's worked for and with so many other prominent executives in your time in terms of working for, whether it be Ted Turner, George Steinbrenner, working with Billy Payne, who, of course, has moved on to the Augusta National since running the Olympic Committee, and working above a very famous executive in his own right, and Eric Bischoff. Are there any commonalities among these guys? I mean, they all seem to be very driven, very type A personalities. They're all very charismatic types. Are there any things about any of these guys, either individually or collectively, that jump out at you when I mention those names?
Well, I think that in general terms, they are uncommon individuals. I think that's a term that I would use, in that each one approached problems in a different kind of way. All of them, each and every one of them, expected that things would be done in the best way. And, I mean, it didn't matter whether it was the food being served or what was being done on the broadcast or the music that was played or the talent that you had. So I think that expectation was the one generality that was shared by all of them. Each one had a different knowledge base. You know, Ted came out of the sign industry. He had built a superstation. George had come out of a family out of the shipping business, but at the same time had this love for athletics in a very different kind of way. Eric is a unique individual in that he was both a talent and a producer and a director, which, you know, operates at a very, very different level. When you put them all together and you throw in people like General LeMay, who commanded SAC that I had the opportunity to work under at a distance, and so forth, I think each one of them brings something different to the table. I think that was the beauty of getting to work with all of them. Each one, as we all do, me and everyone else, had some failings that you worked around. The one thing that each one of them expected from me was, I have something that's of value. I want you to make it better. Don't hurt it. So whether it was the Yankees or the Nets or whether it was the Devils or whether it was the Southeastern Conference schools or whether it was all of the assets that Turner Broadcasting had, you know, from being the president of the hockey team to working with the Braves and the Hawks, you know, the expectation was that you're going to make it better, but you're never going to be in a position to do anything to harm that treasured element.
That's very, very interesting to hear about all the different perspectives there. I dare say, Dr. Schiller, not to tell you your business, but it seems to me there's a pretty good management book in that for you. You've been privileged to work with so many of these guys. I didn't even know that that General LeMay was among them. But my goodness, you've got something there if you want to go for it.
Well, I've been asked several times. You know, the problem is as you start to delve into it, what people are interested in, it becomes very personal, and you still had, although some have passed away, that you still have personal relationships. And you honor that because they respect that in you. So you have to be careful with
sure.
that. There, you know, the idea of doing it as a learning thing is important, but to do it just to make money is not worth it.
Yeah, I imagine it's walking a fine line to do that and do it in the right way. It's very striking as we trace through because, you know, these jobs, all of them, your titles, the positions that you were at, the institutions, all having such gravitas to them, it's kind of funny that, you know, of the things that you might be known for publicly, I mean, you're known regionally, I suppose, in different areas for things that you've done, whether with the Yankees or the Thrashers or whatever, but to Joe Blow on the street in any random market, the first thing they might think of is WCW. You were featured a little bit and talked about more, even when you weren't on camera, on the hottest show on cable during the biggest boom period in the history of the industry. Now, we on this show have always liked and appreciated wrestling, and we've spent a fair amount of time on it as we've gone along. What were your thoughts? What were your exposure to it before then? And as far as being as well-known as you are for your association with it at that time, is that something that amuses you or annoys you, or where do you come out on that?
Well, it was something that was thrown in my lap. The leadership that was done before it was handed to me was a bit unusual. You have to remember that even now with Vince, with McMahon and WWE and so forth, the majority of the money that's made in professional wrestling is made from the pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
The syndicated shows and the arena shows and so forth all build up to the pay-per-view. That's where the value proposition is. When I was at Turner, WCW had, we had about 135 wrestlers on the contract because we were building out arena shows as well as television shows, not just those on Turner, but those that were syndicated in other places. All of that, you know, was a business that one had to focus on. How do you do it the best way? A number of the wrestlers had very, very lucrative contracts, and some of those that were minor players had what you would call, you know, sort of a rookie kind of contract in a sport like baseball or football. In any event, it was something that I had little experience with. On the learning curve, it was to getting to know the people and to create characters. One of the challenges that you have in professional wrestling is that you build a character like Hulk Hogan, who was the character himself, and the value is Hulk Hogan. The character is not like Mickey Mouse that's owned by Disney. It's owned by Hulk Hogan. So there's a challenge in managing those assets over time where the leverage stays with the character, and if the character is owned by the wrestler himself or herself, then you're in a very, very tight situation in terms of your ability to make a profit.
Yes, sir. I think I know the two words you're talking about, creative control. So.
Yep.
That could be
a
real
funny story. That one of the sponsors that we had at the time, if I remember correctly, was Spam, and we decided to create a new character called Spam Man, and the Spam people said no, it didn't fit well because it would diminish the value of their product, which I thought was funny.
Well, that is kind of funny. I don't remember seeing Spam on the menu last time at Morton's Steakhouse, so yeah, that's they may not have a real accurate image of their own product. But the one follow-up question I would have for you, because you talked about the importance of pay-per-view, and I know what you mean by that. I know you're talking about on the TV side, but I have to ask nevertheless here too, because I'm sure you're used to doing a pretty good gate at a lot of these things. For example, the Halloween Havoc shows at the MGM in Vegas, you're no doubt doing a good gate. Was it tough to have the Sturgis pay-per-view shows every August be kind of a loss leader because everybody's getting in for free on their bikes? Was that something where that put a little bit of a bite on it, or is that just kind of a drop in the bucket when you're looking at the big picture?
That was a mistake I made. I was the one who pushed to do it in Sturgis, and by the time you shipped everything up there and the production facilities and getting the wrestlers there and the expensive housing on the road and so forth, we lost money. And I thought it would be of greater interest to the bikers, but really it never really turned as good as we thought it would do. Getting back to these big shows that you talk about, the gate is important. And so is the licensed merchandise and everything else. But these are very, very expensive shows when you think about the drama, the lighting, all the other parts that are associated with it. And you need more than just the gate to turn a profit on them. You have to have the media side and, again, all the other sales elements that you have. And Vegas can afford to do some things because they subsidize it. But in general, as just a general arena show, you got to do a lot of them. Just as the circus does or any of the other, professional bull riding or others, you know, they really need to put together a series of things to make it work. But any single gate isn't going to make it.
Well, this is really great stuff, particularly for those who really have an interest in that business and want to understand the intricacies of it. By the way, you, sir, are a real stand-up guy for taking credit for Sturgis, because Eric Bischoff commonly kind of gets saddled with that. For those who think that it was a fiasco, Eric Bischoff gets blamed for it a lot. So you are a stand-up guy for saying that was my idea. And there were some pluses to it,
too. That was absolutely my idea. Eric Bischoff should not take any heat for that. That was my stupidity.
Okay. There were some pluses to it. I mean, it looked cool visually. You know, I wouldn't be too hard on yourself. There were some things that were pretty cool about it. It was different. I know you were looking for different, and you know those things weren't bad. But yeah, the gate there being non-existent.
You know, one of the things I found out is that, and lots of things were tried, is that wrestling fans want real wrestling. Mm-hmm. They want talk, and they want theatrics, and they want wrestling. You know. Putting a guy like Mike Tyson in the ring, in the minds of many people for wrestling, actually takes away the value for they see it, because it implies that it's not real.
Right.
And we put Dennis Rodman in the ring once, and our ratings went down, because you know he's a character, but people would rather believe that what they're watching is real, or has a real element to it. And when you bring in a celebrity just to throw them in there, it's like something you would do on a reality television show to bring in some controversy. But it doesn't really, you know, it's not the reality that the fan wants to see. And Sturgis is a motorcycle event and not a wrestling event.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a pretty splendid assessment of the situation, definitely. From that point on, when you were there, talk about this. This is something that's not very commonly understood in the public mind here, this deal with Yankees Nets. I know that came together right about the time of the YES Network being launched, if I have my chronology correct. They came together on the broadcast side, but it ended up being common ownership as well. You were in a position to lead the situation there for the teams. Talk about everything that went into that, because that had to be a very fascinating little subchapter in sports history.
Well, actually, the network came after the formation of Yankee Nets. Yankee Nets, there were two parts of it. One is the owners of the Nets were looking to enhance the value of their franchise. Some of the investors were emotionally tied to the city of Newark and wanted to put up an arena there for the basketball team, which they now have at the Prudential Center, and move it from the Meadowlands. People like Ray Chambers, who had grown up in the Newark area and following the riots of years ago, wanted to do things to enhance the overall city. That was part one. The governor of then Whitman of the state of New Jersey said, "I'll support an arena in Newark, but you better have two teams, hockey and basketball." That's why we brought in a piece of the Devils at the time. Obviously, time has changed, and the Nets are going to Brooklyn, but the Devils are in Newark, so things don't work out exactly as people planned. But in any event, they do have a new arena in Newark. On the other side of it, George Steinbrenner and I had talked about, as he had with other people, for many years, creating his own television network. The idea of doing a standalone baseball network at the time had its limits, so the idea of bringing in hockey and basketball had some value. And at the time, the television rights to all of those things were controlled by Cablevision, both the MSG network and their other network, their Fox affiliate. So we formed a new company, Yankee Nets, and as I said, we had ownership of the Nets, the Yankees, and a piece of the Devils. And once we had all those assets assembled, we moved forward to create the YES Network, which occurred approximately 2 years after the Yankee Nets was formed.
That was a really, really interesting time, because that was, I guess, more or less around the turn of the century. There was this whole movement towards big mergers and conglomeration, and AOL, Time Warner, I know, happened around in that time. So to what extent do you suppose the coming together of these three teams represented sort of a sign of the times there? It seemed in American business that was the model that everybody was looking at as well.
It was at the time, but things have moved away from that. Common ownership by major corporations. Remember, Turner owned a baseball team, a basketball team, and a hockey team. And Disney owned a number of elements as well. But over time, those things were
you know, when the economy started to shift early on in the 2000, a little bit later, people were focused in business on their primary product. And if it was media, that was their primary product. If it was sports, it was their primary product. You might remember that at the same time, a company like Sears unloaded their Allstate insurance group and so forth. What were you really, a retailer, or were you an insurance agent? So all of those things had an effect across corporate America, and you began to see more independence among the teams. But at the same time, the S Network was able to go from a zero basis to a value over $3 billion today.
Wow.
We had built a regional network, or several of them, at Turner, and which eventually became Turner South, now Fox down there, because we needed to have an outlet for the Braves. So these things had happened around the nation, and now, of course, the Lakers have started their own network. The Big Ten has a network. The SEC has a digital network. The Pac-10 is looking at starting their own network. So, you know, it's not over yet. I don't know where it's all going. My prediction is that there'll be a player that no one knows. It could be Netflix becomes the distributor of sports programming. It could be Google, or it could be some other entity that none of us are thinking about now.
That's true. For as quickly as things spring up, really, I mean, a half decade ago, where was Twitter, and, you know, a little bit before that, where was Facebook? So absolutely, it could be something that none of us have even heard of yet. But that's in the last dozen or so years, with all these networks that have sprung up like this, that is really interesting to think about you being on the leading edge of that with your time there with Yankees Nets. Additionally, as far as it goes with baseball, I know you spent some time heading up the International Baseball Federation. I know that that's an administrative job as far as overseeing worldwide baseball operations, but I wonder to what extent, and this pops into my head because we'd had him on the show previously, somebody like Tommy Lasorda, who's such a great ambassador for the game, how much of your time was taken up with international promotion of baseball with some of these type of figures?
Well, complete. Of course, Major League Baseball has the Baseball Classic, and the goal, I was elected to be the president to try to keep baseball in the Olympic Games. That was not going to happen for a variety of reasons. My take is that the IOC members wanted new sports, and they've added golf and rugby sevens and throughout softball and baseball. Might have been a little bit of anti-Americanism in part of that. I'm not sure. Certainly baseball is a global sport. People are playing it even in places like India. But in the Caribbean and Latin America and Asia, you know, the success of baseball in Japan and now Chinese Taipei and in Korea, as well as even in places like the Netherlands and Italy. But it was a frustrating time because we hit a wall in trying to bring it back into the games. I don't know if it'll ever happen. If it doesn't, I think Major League Baseball will do and operate in a similar way as FIFA does in soccer, that it will be its own entity and it'll continue to grow that way.
Hopefully it will make it back. I mean, the World Baseball Classic has been tremendous, but yeah, it's no substitute for having baseball in the Olympics. That's for sure. I know that in your present position here that you are continuing to be a leader as far as being the CEO and chairman of Global Options Group as far as their risk mitigation efforts. And if we have found this not to be the case always in the past with Wikipedia being reliable, Wikipedia also lists you as vice chair of Diversified Search, Ogders Burnden. Is that correct as well?
Yeah, it is. I took on that position helping to grow the company. Diversified is separating itself from Ogders right now. And, you know, it's going to build itself as a global entity, which it is here domestically in executive search business. But I've always had a leaning towards mentoring people and helping them find positions and jobs and been a resource in a lot of ways. And I felt at this point in my life it was something that I felt I could give back in helping a company grow to help people find jobs.
As far as your time right now as a CEO and as a corporate leader, the one thing that it doesn't have in common with the last couple of decades here is the direct sports experience here. You've spent a lot of times administratively for sports, or as we talked about with WCW Sports Entertainment, as the case may be. What are some of the things that you find challenging and really kind of enlightening and gratifying in your present path?
Well, it's all about people, helping build a new organization. We were fortunate enough to build Global from a $5 million to $120-plus million company and take it public and go from about 16 employees to almost 600. But the economy's been very, very tough on companies of that size, which may seem big to some but are small in the corporate environment in America. And we've been in the process of selling off our assets back to the people we bought them from, the 10 or 11 companies that we bought over time. So it's these past 3 years, when most people are talking about real estate and job creation and so forth, the small business world is the one that's been the most challenging for a variety of reasons. So I'm still with it, and we're continuing to focus on the company and distribute our proceeds to our shareholders, as well as taking on this new position in diversified search.
Well, as somebody working on building a small business in this climate, sir, I know exactly what you're talking about and the challenges that have been evident, particularly in the last 3 years or so. What I'm curious about here, what I know about Global Options Group is that it's involved with battling fraud in the business sector here. I have to imagine at a time like this, in a climate like the last couple of years, where there's really, in the good times maybe, businesses can afford a little bit of fat here or there and some things that, I mean, they may not like it, but it may not be as critical against them if they had to have it. At a time like this, when everybody is fighting for survival, particularly, as you said, with small business here, what role does a firm like yours play in helping these institutions to stay afloat and to make sure that there's no fat in the form of things that shouldn't be occurring?
Well, across the board of services, it does exactly that. And whether it's fraud in workman's compensation or backgrounds on corporations or individuals. We also own a DNA lab to supplement state crime laboratories. The combination of those things all have prepared, or really done a public service. So that's the beauty of the company, which I've always felt about, that it does contribute to the general good of society. And again, at the same time, those businesses will still be operating. They'll be doing it more independently as opposed to part of a major public company.
Well, it's a really interesting chapter in what's been a great career, no question about it, Dr. Schiller. We always love to give our guests a chance to plug here on the show, so if there's anything that we didn't hit sufficiently in the time here, please take it away.
Well, it's always a great experience to be able to share some of these experiences and thoughts with you and your listeners. And, you know, I know most people have a dream about being involved in sports at some level. And what I tell everyone, and I think you've heard me say this in the groups that have been assembled before, is that you got to think about building relationships and friendships that are well beyond what you do every day in business and employment. And those things are typically the ones that have the greatest reward, the avocation where you volunteer your time. That's how I got started. It's just a simple volunteer giving up my time for the Olympics and for the college world, and one thing led to another, and I've had a very unusual opportunity to touch all of those things at every level. So I wish you well on your podcast, and thanks for having me on.
Dr. Schiller, it's been our pleasure. We'd love to have you on and catch up with you some more, sir. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you. I'll do that.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. We'll look forward to it. Appreciate it. Dr. Harvey Schiller, everybody. We love having him on the show here tonight. Gotta love, again, a guy with that kind of diversity and breadth of experience, and he talked about it at the end there, the philosophy that's guided him through there, the way that he deals with people and nurtures the kind of human relationships that need to be successful, to go from being a brigadier general in the Air Force to leading up Turner Sports, being the supervisor over the executives running WCW as part of the time there, running the Atlanta Thrashers, the Southeastern Conference, U.S. Olympic Committee, Yankees, Nets, International Baseball Federation, and then, by the way, too, in his previous time as a brigadier general in his first career, which, by the way, a lot of people would kick back and go to the beach after retiring as a brigadier general alone, but to do all this as a more or less second career, earning the Legion of Merit and Distinguished Flying Cross, somebody who really did great things for his country as he was coming up through the Air Force.